So what's President Trump up to? Does he want to take down the Republican Party and remake it in his own image?
I don't believe anyone doubts the American people's values or the commitment of the American government or the government's agencies to advancing those values and defending those values.
And the president's values?
The president speaks for himself, Chris.
We are back with the TrumpCast Book Club. I'm delighted to be joined today by Katie Roifey and Philip Gurevich, who you'll remember from earlier in the year. We took a literary summer hiatus. We were planning to discuss today's book, Strangers in Their Own Land, by Arlie Russell Hochschild, a couple months ago, and we ran into some scheduling troubles, but we've all read it, and we're loaded and ready to discuss it. But I don't know, before we get into that, how was your summer, guys? Katie, how was your summer?
Excellent. I mostly was slothful and vacationing.
But I bet you did some good reading. What was the best book you read?
Favorite book? It's hard to say because I read a lot of great books. I'm reading this book by David Plant, and it's called Difficult Women. And it's about Germaine Greer and Jean Rhys, and it's his encounters with these incredibly brilliant women, like after their decline, like in their difficult, even most difficult years. And it's just these beautiful vignettes of these kind of like road trips he took with Germaine Greer in Tulsa.
What a great title. But he didn't have Kate Millett, who died recently.
No.
Yeah. She wasn't that difficult.
No. Well, same idea.
Difficult in a different way. And Philip, welcome back. How about, did you read any good books to recommend? Not about Trump?
Yeah, I was, I actually think maybe the best book I read this summer was James Rebank's The Shepherd's Life. And he's a shepherd from Northern England, from Cumbria and the Lake District, who's like many multi, it's a story of being like the heir to a multi-generation ancient tradition of grazing these sheep. And in some ways, it's a book that's very much about the work. It's really about a particular kind of working and farm life, but it's also very much about issues that are in play in our country too now, but not explicitly politically, just in the sense of, here's this guy from this small town and school seems worthless and it's a sorting system and it's a class system, but he actually finds his way to Oxford at one point, and he's just incredibly bright and versatile, but he really wants to work back on this farm. And it's beautifully written. It's quite varied. It's very good on fathers and sons. It's very good on sheep, which I have no prior deep commitment to as a subject. And it's excellent.
I love that. An actual literary shepherd. He's got all these, but he can answer the poets who've been writing about him for thousands of years.
Well, this is what's fascinating, is he really says, the poets have been writing about us for thousands of years, but we're never really, our real lives are never at all in these poems. And the whole fetishization of the Lake District and of the romance of the bucolic rural life, and then of country homes being bought, I mean, the farms being bought up by basically gentrification of a sort and tourism. He's like, we're never visible in that. We're always looked past. We're actually a little bit of an eyesore for the scenic view of our lives. And so he's sort of writing himself into this history and also writing himself backwards, because he's kind of a scholar of history and goes back thousands of years and looks at the way this way of life has evolved or not. It's really, I recommend it.
That sounds really interesting. You know, we usually do the recommendations at the end of the show, but I thought today we'd get started with them. And I also, I brought a little wine for us. It's late in the afternoon, and we have some very good podcast wine here, which was sent to us by one of our podcast advertisers, Wink. So I'll just maybe open this if you guys would like to join me in a glass.
Sure.
While we
sure.
get the conversation started. So
sounds good.
Before I ask you guys what you thought of the book, I want to ask you a little bit about the question this book takes on, which is essentially, as I understood it, the problem of why many Americans, working class Americans, vote against their own interests, their own economic interests. And Hochschild frames this with reference to a book that got a lot of discussion over a decade ago, What's the Matter with Kansas, by Thomas Frank, which basically frames the same question. Why is Kansas, you know, one of the most conservative Republican states in the country, despite the fact that these policies have in many ways devastated this state and this place? It's, in some ways, it's the problem of false consciousness, right? Which is Tom Frank's kind of more direct Marxist answer, which is, well, these people misunderstand their own interests. They've been bamboozled by Republican politicians.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not really her answer.
No, I thought her answer was a bit more complicated and a bit more interesting than that, in part because she does to an extent, and Philip will disagree with me here a little bit.
I'm just going to pour you a little wine.
But I think she does to an extent talk about some of the more irrational kind of psychological, emotional things going on. For instance, she talks about how committed a lot of these people are to the big businesses that are kind of crushing them because they are seeing them as vehicles for dignity. My grandfather, my father, they're sort of seeing, instead of, you know, this horrible, polluting, corrupt company, they're seeing like, this is how our family kind of like bought our house. And they're seeing these companies as giving them this kind of status. And it's a much more kind of emotional, and it's irrational, and it's kind of cloudy and murky. But she does try to examine those kind of irrational commitments and ideas.
Philip, does she portray these people as having had the wool pulled over their eyes, or pulling the wool over their own eyes? I mean, why?
More the latter.
Yeah.
She sort of says she was spurred by the Franks book to think about this problem. But she doesn't buy entirely his argument that it's a strictly economic bamboozling by the big powerful interests in the media, though she sees how they benefit from it. And then she sets out also the differences. I mean, Franks is writing about his own state in Kansas, and she sets out very much, I am an echt liberal from Berkeley. I know nobody like this. Like, she sets it up as if she's going into deepest Borneo or something, you know. And we are going to go and see with these utterly incomprehensible people. I need to try to comprehend them. Right. So she sets out as a sociologist, cultural anthropologist, and she presents it. And this is where I found it was problematic in some ways, but also maybe leads to what's insightful about it, as a question of empathy, she keeps using the same terms, this empathy wall between these different visions of America, the sort of liberal, Berkeley liberal, which she keeps playing herself up as a Berkeley liberal, and these Tea Partiers in Louisiana. And she picks Louisiana specifically because of what she, again, her terminology, the keyhole issue she's looking at this through, which is environmental harm rather than simply economic harm. It's the way they're working against their own interest is most directly in that they are killing themselves systematically on a very large scale. The families that she's meeting have horrible, horrible stories of the devastation of their communities and their ways of life by the petrochemical industry and other industries in the areas they've lived for a long time in Louisiana. And they can't eat the fish that they fish, and they can't eat the hunting that they hunt. Mm. And their kids are dying, and their houses are falling into sinkholes, and they're being evacuated from whole neighborhoods. Mm. And the corporations say, well, that's the sacrifice zone. And literally write these whole things off and take no responsibility. And none of them trust government at all, which in Louisiana is perhaps not irrational. It's really one of the worst.
Given how corrupt it is, yeah, how ineffective government is. Yeah.
But also they keep voting for these politicians who they openly seem to see as ideologically aligned with them as anti-regulation, even though it's the regulation is the only hope of ever getting some sort of control over what's literally killing them.
My favorite thing about this book was, by the way, there's a diagram in the book of the poison fish, you know, where there's like a diagram of if you fish this polluted fish that's so toxic that it will probably harm you and give you cancer, here's the way to cut it and like get the meat out of it so that you can eat it.
But if you're going to eat it,
here's how you do it. And the reason it was kind of interesting to me, it was a kind of amazing metaphor for this idea of like, why are you continuing to fish the fish? Like, you're still committed to going your own same place, fish out the fish. And then there's like a way to survive, even though it's like this insane, Byzantine way to survive. So I feel like the commitment to eating the poison fish is kind of connected to this false consciousness that we're talking about, or this kind of unwillingness to reject what seems so obviously to be the problem, or kind of analyze it in that way.
Although I got to say, having grown up in the Midwest with fish from the Great Lakes, which were very polluted in the 70s, I remember being told a version of the same thing without the diagram, which is you don't eat the skin and you don't eat the fat. And I think they would even say that with fish from the Hudson River, which you're now considered okay to eat in small quantities.
And ducks. Because ducks have a very fatty, and so like all these duck hunters and bird hunters would end up you know, they hold a lot of the junk in them.
But when you pointed out the instructions on eating poison fish does seem a little bit insane. I mean, I guess I got hung up in a couple places in this book, and one of them was right with that around that phrase, the empathy wall, because I didn't see, I think there's a wall, but I don't see why it's around empathy. There's obviously a huge cultural gap between working class people who live in this toxic environment and work in factories in Louisiana bayous and a sociologist from Berkeley. And there's obviously a huge divergence in worldview and in politics. But I don't see why that necessarily is an empathy gap. And she makes a great show of saying, I'm going to empathize with you and try to see things your way, and I hope you can do the same for me. But I felt it was a bit...
They kind of laugh at her about the do the same with you. I mean, they sort of say, oh, you're from Berkeley, you're a communist, you know, or, okay, well, maybe I'll come see and you can introduce me to some naked hippies. I mean, they're not really
They don't have any trouble empathizing with her in the sense of being a human being standing next to them in line or wants to talk to them.
And liking each other. Like, they all end up kind of liking each other. Well, I agree with you. I felt with the empathy, it was kind of beside the point. I mean, maybe we're all so cynical. We're like, empathy, why would you even try for that? You know, but it seems weirdly beside the point, because to me, the point or what was interesting or valuable about the book was not, I don't really care about who empathizes with who, but it's more about seeing and understanding and like intellectually kind of figuring things out to me as more important than, I mean, obviously this person's a human and you're a human, like those, that's nice, but she's from another generation. And I think maybe our generation's a bit more cynical about the possibilities of a certain kind of politics. And I just don't think I really believe that there's going to be a deep empathy, like you say, between the sociologist from Berkeley, who's just going to go back to her fancy life and how it is, and they're going to go back to their lives. It's not, I don't really believe that there's much potential for that kind of empathy. But I do think understanding like what is going on is a kind of interesting and worthy endeavor.
But what she doesn't try to do directly is persuade these people, because the book is about trying to understand how they see the world and make a case, explain how they see the world. Persuasion is what needs to happen. I mean, and maybe some act of empathy or show of empathy is necessary before you can engage in persuasion. But I don't know if that's true. I mean, is it that we lack empathy, or simply that these worlds have grown so far apart that there is very little communication taking place, hence there's no persuasion taking place in either direction?
Well, one of the problems with the term empathy is it seems to me that it sidesteps the idea of politics and the idea Katie was saying, you know, they're consistently irrational, and she's trying to understand why they make irrational choices. But in fact, she says that's the premise. Is she's not going to try and understand their reason, because she thinks they have none. So each chapter involves a long description of why it's nuts that they think what they think, and then a usually not as detailed description of how they feel about it. It's about feeling. So now there's a lot of truth to the fact that politics is always about emotion and feelings. I think she sort of sees that there's a cultural difference there. And she recognizes that, I mean, there is a really interesting question. Why are they willing to die for this? What is really underlying it? And she gets at it eventually, briefly, but moves on when she gets to race.
Yeah.
That, you know, what they're all saying is, we are losing something. We have lost something. They have physically lost, like, their health, their communities, their homes, their hunting and fishing grounds, and their traditional way of life to petrochemical destruction.
Right.
Most of them have not gotten super rich. A few people have done all right off this industry. And so the question is, what is it that they think they've lost? What is this nostalgia for? And obviously, it's for, you know, pre-1960s and pre-1860s white dominion.
But you're saying that. She doesn't say that.
She says that. She does get to it eventually. She has a little piece on race. And what she has is this idea of the great paradox, which is, why do people do this stuff against their interests? And then she eventually keeps hinting at another one of her terms, the deep story. Mm. And the deep story is a kind of a mythical history that she puts together, a kind of abstract, generalized profile of this person. And that is somebody who is in a sort of row of Sisyphean people, like trying to get up over a mountain. Mm-hmm. In other words, the American dream, striving. They are striving. And throughout history until the 1950s, these are people who felt that they were moving forward and that the world was there.
Right.
as a possibility for them, an opportunity. And now they feel that they're slipping back, that the people behind them in line, and she's very clear about it, yeah, blacks, women. But, you know, they're okay with white women compared to blacks. And, you know, anything brown, like even the brown pelican, which is being protected by the environmental laws, which is the state bird, are all somehow cutting in ahead of them. And so they have this idea of makers and takers. We're the makers, they're the takers. They assume that, like, why should we support a government program when the people who are supporting it are us and the people who are taking from it are other people who are undeserving? And it's very clear throughout this that none of this makes any sense. Except in terms of race,
but and she doesn't. But that's where I want to stop you, Phil, because I think she says there's this deep story, this narrative that they believe, which is that people are cutting ahead of them in line. And yes, it's the brown people and the black people and
Obama
immigrants, Syrian immigrants. Yeah. There aren't any Syrian immigrants this place.
No,
but they think nationally this is what's happening. But she doesn't, and you read that, and I read that, and you think that's crazy. They're not cutting ahead of you in line in any meaningful way. And of course, it's a racist view in the world, but it does get at the loss of relative status these people feel, which could also be explained in economic terms. But she doesn't really come out and say, this is a racist view of the world.
She sort of does.
Some of the people, she kind of goes out of her way to say they're not individually super racist. Like, they're sort of racist. They're racist. She kind of tries to defend the people. And I think that's why she veers away from a kind of stronger head-on tackling with that, because she is kind of in a, she doesn't want to come to that as a conclusion. And I think she also, you know, when she brings up the point, she's like, they also get angry because they think people are getting the aid. They're getting handouts, even though they themselves might need handouts and also
and take them and are getting subsidized in many ways.
But the imagination, they think we are taking care of our own people. Like, they gave at the church, they gave a dollar at the church. And so they have this idea that there are these people, not only are there people ahead of them in line in what you describe, I thought that was kind of gimmicky, but vivid.
It was.
But they're the people in the line and they're trying to like move forward and they're cutting them. But then there's also the fact that everybody's taking and there's not enough. And it's kind of irrational the way sibling rivalry is. It's like, there's never enough cake. There's never enough love. Like, you're always frantic that like somebody's taking, you know, and that mood, I think, it's a little bigger than racism. I just felt like it was partly racism. And it's also about it's about strangers. It's about like a guy not from your town, the guy who doesn't live next door to you. I mean, it's really xenophobia in a very profound way.
See, I think it does come to racism more, and that she hints at it, and she gets at it pretty explicitly, because this is the sort of big revelation of hers in the book, is like, I figured out that they all have this story of, you know, what the ressentiment, you know, that great old Creole Cajun word, you know, but it's resentment. I mean, they're basically filled with resentments, bitternesses, a sense of sort of failure and sort of victimhood that they don't want to call victimhood. And so then you go back and it's like, where did they get defeated? They got defeated in 1860 and 1960. And not only does she come up with this story of the deep story, which is this sort of mythology of the line and falling behind in the line and getting cut in the line. But she tells that story over and over to her subjects. She takes, like, she basically says, like, this is the kind of collective profile I've come up with. And they're all like, bingo.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She's like, does this sound about right to you? They're like, yeah, that sounds good.
So they're, so, so,
you're
so
saying she's feeding it to them.
So she's, well, when they hear it, they don't say it to her. But when she says it to them, they say, bingo. Then she goes to the chapter which says, mentions the 1860s, the 1960s, the South. And suddenly, the one thing that makes this whole thing stitch together, which is, we had dominion. There was a world in which we were supposed to be on top. And somehow, that's no longer the case. So you have to reposit a world in which all those other people just simply don't belong here. Right. And they have to be. So they, and then somebody says, well, I'm not a racist. I stopped using the word nigger in 1968. I never call anybody a nigger anymore. And she says, that's what they all say. Like, I'm not a racist. I don't use the word nigger. And she said, but that is not how people like me consider racism. We consider racism a attitude that believes in and supports and enforces a set of structures in society that see the black or minority person as a sort of subject and inferior person on the social pecking order. Well, that's pretty much her saying.
Yeah, but I think it's, I think Katie hit the point exactly. She's of course is willing to diagnose this as a racist worldview, but she doesn't want to say that people are individually racist because she's climbing over her empathy wall and her empathy boots to make friends with them. And the whole point of the exercise is to not categorize them and write them off, but to try to understand them. But I think that's, in doing that, she runs square into the problem that a lot of liberal America has been dealing with post-Charlottesville, which is exactly the same problem. How do you say, well, you know, a very large percentage of the country sympathizes with Donald Trump's view of Charlottesville. Mm. They don't think the Confederate flag is a racist symbol. We don't want to say, both for tactical and human reasons, well, that 30% of the country or whatever it is irredeemably racist.
Don't want to face that fact if it's true. We want to avoid it. We want to like explain it in a much more palatable way.
And we want to find a way to kind of do what she's saying, which is very sympathetically, oh, this is a racist view, but individuals aren't fully responsible for holding it, or I'm not going to come out and really call them out on their own.
And also, Philip,
this is where she's unpersuasive because she's, and I think it gets to the thing you brought up at the very beginning, Jacob, when you said she doesn't address the question of how would you persuade, confront, discuss, how would you change those minds, right? And unless you do that, you're either saying, and she keeps using this term, my friends in the Tea Party, my friends, my friends, my friends. She sounds like a politician, you know? Like
that's how John McCain talks.
My friend, right. You know, my friend is usually like the person you're about to like try to crush and who's in your way, right? My friend is not my friend. He's the person who thinks everything opposite me. So the question is, she's saying, I want to understand them, but I also want this empathy and friendship approach to understanding them. Why? Why should I be empathetic and friendly towards a racist? That's a bit of a problem. We want to say, have a common community, but we can also say we're in a common community where we have really different views. Actually, our views are incompatible. Her views are not compatible with their views. Yeah. She may wish them well, but she doesn't wish those things well. She is going to continue to fight for policies that would be the policies they're fighting against. And
that's why I was saying, like, empathy is impossible here. It's not even desirable, maybe. It's just this goal of empathy is, I think it's stilting her investigation here, and it really is crippling her a little bit. But I just want to say one thing, which I think you're downplaying the resentment against women that's both in this book and also within this problem. So it's not just racism, but that thing about people getting ahead, which we kind of agree is like an interesting metaphor in this book, is if we look at this in conjunction with what I think is another a great work of reporting, Hannah Rosen's End of Men, where she really goes into different but kind of comparable investigations of people very different from her in a much more reporterly way, kind of less emotional. But what she's uncovering about just this part of this is about men and dignity and men, white men, feeling like they're losing their world. And I do think it's a bit about women. And she talks to some women too. But I think that part of it is there as well. Because when they talk, they're, you know, what they're losing is this status. And they're really looking at women because that's one of the biggest changes. Like we can say race has changed a lot since 1960, but the relation of women, like the way mothers and grandmothers are supposed to be, it's so radically different in this really short amount of time. And they're responding to that as well.
They are. I mean, she takes due note of that very well, and maybe not much less than she notes racism. But by focusing on two of the most successful people financially in the book, who grew up there and worked really hard, are women who are hardcore. There's the hardcore Republican ideologue, and there's the hardcore religious, like, basic fatal. I mean, the other thing is all these people are, like, deep religious fatalists. Mm. Many of them believe in the rapture. They sort of have this view, well, so what if everybody's dying? All my children are dying of cancer in this apocalyptic place. The apocalypse is coming, and then we'll all be raptured up in a little bit of time, and this won't be a problem anymore. And so there's a kind of peasant fatalism that she's confronting that she doesn't really – but with the – I think the women – the issue of women sort of – as competitors in the line for this American dream or striving is huge. I don't think she fully develops that either because she's using these women characters who she doesn't differentiate their attitudes from the attitudes of the men. She doesn't say how is it different that these women who 30 years ago wouldn't be a single mom or a homeowner or a professional operative of the Republican Party or whatever it is, high-powered, right? They're quite high-powered, some of these women. So you're, you know, she doesn't really confront the question of like, well, how come, how have you squared, you know, those sort of conflicting interests of entering this world and then defending it?
I mean, what's a little tricky about that is that the women don't, for the most part, voice views that are that different from the men.
That's what I mean.
But, you know, a sort of premise not quite at the level of her, you know, great chain of being where the white people are losing status. But it was their lives were better before, right? I mean, if you go back to this place 40 or 50 years ago, they had not only had more status, they had better incomes, they had jobs that were in relative terms gave them a higher position in society. And part of what's changed, obviously, is the role of women status. But they don't regard that in the same way, including the women who have suffered from change generally or think they've suffered from change generally. They don't regard that as on the order of blacks becoming empowered and competitors for employment. They don't view it on the order of immigration and these other issues.
And I mean, if you look at the history of the South, she mentions briefly Huey Long, whom she makes sound almost like a Kennedy Democrat. But, you know, he took the Standard Oil men and told them what to do and taxed the hell out of them and built a lot of institutions down there. And then she compares that to Bobby Jindal, who basically took $1 billion government budget surplus and in 8 years ran it down to a $2 billion deficit by giving all the money back to the oil companies that were already there, you know, in these tax cuts. But those Southern voters were Democrats before. And they're now Republicans. And they've had, and it is somewhat irrational in terms of a lot of their other interests. It has not profited them. But what shifted was which party was where on the race issue. Mm. I mean, that honestly is it. Now, it is also on the women issue, but then she finds these women Republicans whom she doesn't fully explain, though she does say that in polls and in private conversations, the women are much quicker to say that they would lose more if government regulations and programs were cut as much as the Tea Party wants them to be than men. They're more reluctant to see all that go, and they're more sort of aware of the fact that they've somehow benefited from the social changes that they're also now digging their heels in against.
So how do the Democrats go after these people? I mean, the Republicans have figured out a way to say in a very tribal way, we are on your side. And the story about how they're on their side is totally implausible. We're on your side because we support lower taxes and deregulation and no more immigration. And that's going to restore the past utopia. And of course, none of those things have any effect on the macro factors that are making these people's lives worse. To the extent these policies make a difference, they make things in the Bobby Jindal way. They accelerate the decline. But what's the Democratic story? How do the Democrats say, we're on your side and we have an answer that's better?
Well, but the problem is with what Philip's saying is true, which is if a big central issue here is I hate people who are different from me, the Democrats are never going to win that game. You know, if that's the underlying emotional reality, and
Louisiana has a Democratic governor right now. I mean, they finally got rid of
like, pro-life,
right? And
crucial.
Old boy, right. Like maybe a more kind of. I mean, there could be a Democratic person of that kind, but I think once you start again with the kind of identity politics that Democrats will feel like, I mean, it's tricky to think about how the Democratic inclusiveness is not going to sound like I'm on the side of the people cutting in line.
Well, they don't have to win all of them, first of all. I mean, Democrats, at least nationally, don't have to win all of them. And locally, they have to. I mean, so one of the questions is, if you're in a place where the Republicans have skillfully or out of pure sincerity monopolized an issue that is separate from race and separate from economic exploitation, like right to life, and made that an issue which many people are unbending on, or guns, right? And the Democrats, as a national party, are just never going to go the other way on those to the satisfaction of people for whom those are sort of single issue votes. And many people just don't care about the rest. They're like, you know, I'm not going to do those two things. Those are enough for me. And then, well, look, you've got a pro-life Democratic governor down in Louisiana now. How would he fit in with the rest of the party? Pretty awkwardly, honestly. Are we are Democrats, you know, sort of willing to do that? Are we prepared to sort of see a debate where that's going to get all split? I don't know.
Well, in general, I would say the Democrats have not been. You know, the other big example being Bob Casey and Pennsylvania, who, you know, came in for very rough treatment with the National Party and at the conventions and so on. And, you know, a pro-life Democrat, I'm a pro-choice Democrat, but the way that pro-life Democrats, and there aren't that many of them,
right,
but I favor tolerating them, partly because I don't think there's any great moment to their views. Nothing's going to shift.
Exactly.
But they're treated like pariahs. But that tolerate being more tolerant and accepting of them in places like Louisiana in the South may be one of the keys to becoming competitive with the people described in this book, white Southerners.
But another thing is, I just feel like one of the things she's getting at here is that the content of what's being said is less important than something vaguer and more about personality. And Trump, we see it with Trump, is obviously projecting in his outsiderness, no matter what he does, no matter what he says, no matter how incompetent he is, he's projecting something as a personality that people are responding to. And I feel like with the Democrats, it's ultimately not going to be about platform. It's going to be about finding a person who is projecting. And I don't think, frankly, that person would ideally be a woman or a black man. I think it's about projecting a personality that people can respond to that they think is sending them signals of acceptance.
I mean, let's not forget that Obama won two elections a lot more solidly than Trump won
this
one.
Exactly.
And he did it with some of the same voters. And Bill Clinton knew how to talk to Southern white people at working class without necessarily giving them these Tea Party politics at all.
Exactly. They're responding to something in him.
So it's a kind of cultural language. It's an ability to sort of say, I don't disdain you. I don't my choices aren't simply those in which I completely reject your way of life. Is, you know, one of the things, because what's really interesting is the fallback position is like Fox News these days, right? Some terrible thing comes out about Trump having done something monstrous. So immediately you'll see on Twitter that what's on Fox News? A new Benghazi report, you know, another turn of the Clinton tapes,
right,
or emails, you know, and you sort of say, so they're just completely saying, you know, yeah, but right, remember why you're with us. You're with us because we're against them.
Right.
But more against Hillary specifically. I think the anger against Hillary and Obama, but it's not about Bill Clinton. I think Bill Clinton's a really interesting figure to bring up because I do feel like he did appeal to these voters.
Well, I'm sorry,
more,
he was a poor white Southerner himself, so there's no empathy wall for him to climb over.
No, he's just not climbing.
You know, and culturally, he doesn't send any signals of being other or against them or not. It's plausible that he's upholding the interests of these people.
He knew how to talk to people about from that world and not be seen simply as the Yale, Oxford neoliberal that, you know, his wife was seen as.
Weirdly, people may have hated Obama, but Obama had a little bit of that quality of like being able to seem like he understood you or empathy. I mean, he had a little more of that quality. I mean, obviously he had a bigger...
He's half a white boy from Kansas, let's remember.
And he did very well in downstate Illinois, you know, when he was in the legislature.
Sure.
I mean, he did... I think that's an important point. I mean, he has white grandparents from Kansas. He had an idea how to talk to these people.
He knows how to talk to people. He knew how to talk.
I mean, he knew how, when you could hear his grandfather's voice, his mother's father's voice coming through him at times in a way that would have seemed very weird from another Chicago black politician who was, you know, let's say Jesse Jackson, who would just be like Jesse Jackson to them, you know.
But we have to admit that Trump doesn't know how to talk to people. Like the, you know, going to the people in the shelter in Texas and saying, have a great time. Like he just has no idea what you're supposed to say when you're supposed, I mean, he's really bad at talking to people.
He's a good showman, though. He's an extraordinary entertainer.
He's
of
very
sorts,
good at entertaining
and he's
people.
He's great at riling up the
but
emotions.
But not necessarily on purpose or in the way he means to. Like I think he mesmerizes and transfixes, but not always in, he's not always in control of it, like how he's, Clinton was better as a at least more, he knew what he was doing and how he was manipulating the world.
Yeah, those guys all won the popular vote. I mean, and it's not negligible. So I think, but one thing I'd like to say in terms of how will you reach people, maybe don't reach them by persuading them on these issues, which nobody wants to be persuaded on. No, the whole thing is they don't want to be told how to behave any more than we do by them. and you know, people who have different views. And I don't want like this whole us and them thing, but you know, like there's a spectrum in the country, right? And she goes for the extreme there. And she sort of presents herself as the other extreme as a Berkeley liberal. And I'm sure that I'm somewhere along the way. I doubt I'm aligned with her, you know, on a lot of these things. But the fact is, what about healthcare? Suddenly you have an issue there that they say they don't want. But when it's about to be taken away, they do want it. Mm. And if you can deliver services and deliver benefits and results that the other party has sought to obstruct or take away, and the people who are sick are suddenly finding that they're getting better care for a better deal. So they all hate Obamacare, but they sure like their ACA, mm. right? That's pretty interesting. And in a time that's this polarized, to see the shift in opinion that we've seen in the last 9 months from against Obamacare to defending it, that's like moved 10 points or something. That's a huge shift in the kind of hard set divisions that we're looking at. That's the way you get through. You know, if we now see Elizabeth Warren, I think just on the day that we're recording this, may have just come out saying she's going to support the same single payer sort of thing as Bernie Sanders. If that becomes the Democratic platform, that's the kind of place where people, as they get disgruntled with Trump, as they feel that Trump failed them, which I think it's clear that some of these voters will. And she makes it clear even in her book that although, there's a kind of problem here, which is she keeps talking about the Tea Party, but the Tea Party became the Republican Party under Trump. It sort of got subsumed into Trumpism. But some of those people didn't fully like him for various reasons, as church people, things about his crudeness, suspicions that he was a big talker. If those people are peeled away and somebody with a populist message from the left that actually involves we're going to deliver things comes along, that might make a difference. Nobody felt that. Clearly, Hillary Clinton was good at communicating such things.
So you're back to a New Deal politics. It's just transactional. Give them benefits that they want and won't want to lose, and they will ultimately vote their economic interests. There won't be anything the matter with Kansas anymore.
No, I'm not sure that there won't be anything the matter with it, but you sort of say, like, you know what, about the business of this country being more diverse than Cajuns? Yeah, that's just something you're going to have to live with. That's right. They're going to be people who, and some of them are getting ahead of you because of merit, and some of them are getting ahead of you because of policies that are adjusting long-term injustices. And by the way, being a poor Southern, you know, what they called, these guys resent being called rednecks, but what they were called in Huey Long's time was a peckerwood. You know, they were not like at the peak of their power. They had a short period where oil was paying them in the 70s and 80s, maybe 60s, 70s and 80s. And unions were strong. These people have been totally gutted by the collapse of unions under their party.
I came away from this book with like a darker feeling. Maybe you have the same or maybe not. But I just had a darker view that the gap somehow the way they were talking about things felt so detached from these realities. Like, but you have when you would make that argument, but you have really good healthcare. Yes, they want the healthcare, but it seemed so that the fantasy of oneself plays into this so dramatically, you know, into your politics and your allegiances here, and all of these kind of feelings about being accepted or you know the home or whatever it is were so powerful and these mythologies were so powerful that it didn't give me a lot of hope in like a practical solution like that or in the possibility of progress in that particular way.
No, same. I mean, I think this book depicts a really deep irrationalism and it didn't leave me with a lot of hope for doing anything about it. I just think at some fundamental level, you've got to figure out how not to condescend to these people. You've got to treat them like equals. You've got to treat them with respect. And part of that is not indulging their irrationalism. When they're doing things that are against the national interest, when they're doing things that are against their own interest, you should
argue
not.
With it.
Yeah, I think you should argue with it. And that's what she was holding back from doing in the book. And that's what I think I ultimately found frustrating is she wasn't engage respectfully with people. At some point, you say, I profoundly disagree with what you're saying, if you do. And she never wants to kind of come out and say that to friends in the Tea Party.
Except she keeps on heaping on data that shows, you know, that they don't make any sense in her view, right? The data is crushingly on the side of you are irrational.
She doesn't necessarily give that to them. She's just more giving that to the reader.
Right. But it's kind of her point of view is I was bewildered that in the face of, and then you get sort of 7 pages of just crushing data, they felt, so what? And you know, religion obviously is a big piece of this in the way that they structure their sense of, like, we're not looking to politics, we're looking to the church. But there was a fascinating piece just the other day, I can't remember where it was, that was showing that there are 20 states here in the United States where the majority of people do not consider themselves, like, overtly religious. Where we have this idea that, oh, everybody outside the big cities or the sort of, you know, super liberal policy elite are deeply churchy. And that's not actually the case. But she found this particular, I mean, one of the things she also doesn't tell us is how much do these people represent? These people, not meaning the white working class, but this particular group of subjects represent something beyond this particular Lake Charles, Louisiana milieu that she's digging into so deeply.
All right, answer me this last question. Is this a book you would recommend people to understand Trump's America? Is it one of the books people should read if they want to get a grip on the present moment? And if you give me a good answer, I'll give you a little more wine. I'll give you a little more wine anyway.
You go first, Philip.
I found it hard going, and I feel like things are moving so fast these days, and we're absorbing so much information that there wasn't a lot in there. And this is not taking away from what she did, because she put it, but at this point, probably a year after it went to press, it didn't feel to me like there was a ton in there that gave me insight into Trump's America that I hadn't pretty well digested in the last 6 months.
Katie?
I don't necessarily know if I could recommend it. I was glad I read it when I read it. And it made me look forward to other versions of this, people taking on this challenge and answering it. So what it really kind of left me with is not necessarily that people should read it, though I was glad I read it, but a hunger for more books like this, maybe better books like this, maybe, like Philip was suggesting, more kind of honest and far, like taking things deeper and analyzing things more, that it made me want more books like this.
Yeah. I mean, I'll answer it too. I think she's asking the right question. And I like the creative way of going at it with this mix of sociology and journalism. Mm-hmm. For some reason, the execution was a little bit irksome and unsatisfying, but the project is worth doing. And I think we should be looking for more books that are trying to do versions of this.
I'm looking forward to Eliza Griswold's Fracking. She's doing an investigation of an area that I think is going to be interesting. But I think there are books in the works. I'm sure there are many more.
And we'll be back to talk about them on the TrumpCast Book Club. That's it for the September edition of the TrumpCast Book Club. And I'm ready to announce our October selection. We'll be back to talk about The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood. If you have not read The Handmaid's Tale, you should read it. Watching the Hulu series is not enough, good as it was, and we're going to talk a little bit about that too. So please get a copy of The Handmaid's Tale and join us in a month for the TrumpCast Book Club. TrumpCast was produced today by Jason DeLeon. Thanks again to Katie Roifey and Philip Gurevich of The New Yorker. I'm Jacob Weisberg. Thanks for listening to TrumpCast.